honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode reflecting on the incredible life of Louis Zamperini. His death-defying mission over Nauru was 80 years ago this weekend. His death-defying mission over Nauru was 80 years ago this week, but it was everything that followed that would come to define this prisoner of war's inspirational story. Before we hear more of Louis's memories, a few thoughts from Laura Hillenbrand, author of the bestseller about his life, Unbroken.
I had to write a book about him. We had our first conversation. He told me his whole story. We talked for quite a long time, and I was just astonished by it and so compelled by all the questions that raised in my mind about how a person can forgive the unforgivable and recover from suffering as deep as he went through. I had no thoughts about what the audience might be for this, but I did think people would be interested in it. No, I didn't. I don't think anybody expects the reach the story has had, but then again, why shouldn't I have expected it? He has maybe the most extraordinary life I've ever heard of.
It really is. And what's amazing is he'd been telling his story to small groups, large groups for a long time, but yet most of the world didn't know about it until you put it in print.
A lot of history goes to the grave with people. A lot of history just goes untold. And it's a wonderful privilege to be able to talk to these people who have lived superlative lives as Louis did, and to be able to write it down, to try to research and learn more about their own lives than they knew themselves, you know, about things that were happening because of them or around their story, and to try to tell the whole thing in context. It's a great privilege and it's a great pleasure.
I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, and it's hard to come up with one thing, but when people ask you about Louis, about your interactions with him or your experience in capturing his story, if there's one single greatest significant aspect of who he was and what the rest of us can learn from his experience and the way he handled it, what do you think that would be?
I think what Louis and the life he lives has taught us is that our potential to be resilient, to endure, and to overcome is far greater than we give ourselves credit for. We are not going to be going through the same experiences he went through, but most of us are going to face things in our lives that are bigger than we are, or so we think. And what Louis has to say about that is, it's not bigger than you. Nothing's bigger than you. You can overcome this. You can apply your resilience. You have it in you. And I hear it all the time, and he did too, that, you know, if you got through what you got through, I can get through this camp. I can get through this loss, or I can get through this thing I fear. And I think that's what he wanted people to know. It was very, very important to him to use his suffering for good. And that's what he did. He taught us this lesson. I carry it with me every day of my life.
Well, and that was my follow-up, and I don't want to cross any lines or get too personal if you don't want to, but as you say that, I'm thinking, boy, it sure sounds like Laura has applied this in her own life, that there's things that you've had to take that, you know, fighting spirit that Louis exemplified and apply it to your own circumstances.
Well, one of the things Louis knew that a lot of people didn't know about me is that I've had a pretty terrible chronic illness for 30 years, something called myalgic encephalomyelitis, and it was a devastating illness that for a number of years left me completely bedridden. And for much of the time that I worked on the book, I actually was bedridden. And Louis knew this, and because he knew it, he felt that I could understand something about suffering and about confinement and being separated from your body's capacity to do what it does naturally, you know, to be an athlete or to just be out in the world. He knew I got that, even though I hadn't been through the same kind of experience he had been through. And it enabled him, he said, to really open up to me in a way that he hadn't with anybody else, to really, really tell me the story. Because veterans very often fear opening up about what they went through because they're afraid, people will not understand and it will be trivialized to them. It will look like it did in bad old war movies that don't really capture what these things are. And it was an interesting place where Louis and I met, this place of suffering and deprivation. And I was able to take his strength sometimes when I was feeling really badly. I could talk to him and I could be renewed. I could keep going. When it was very, very hard. There was a span while I was writing this book that for 2 years I was unable to leave my house because I was simply too weak to walk to my car. And Louis helped carry me through that time just with his buoyance, his effervescence, his belief in me. And that was a beautiful thing.
Laura Hillenbrand, author of Unbroken, which allowed Louis's incredible story to reach so many millions more around the world. Let's conclude the show with more from that 2011 interview with Louis here on Hometown Heroes.
Your story is so unbelievable, Louis. From you could have been shot to death in the plane, you could have drowned, you could have starved to death, you almost did. Now you're almost beaten to death in captivity. So when you got to that moment where you were finally liberated, how wonderful a day was that for you?
Well, that was it was a beautiful day. We were suspicious. You see, there's always rumors the war's over, so we didn't believe anything. But this one guard came to me and he said, a horrible thing happened in a city called Hiroshima. A cholera broke out, and nobody can communicate with Hiroshima. And I thought, cholera, my God, how horrible. I'm glad we're hundreds of miles north. But that was the first atomic bomb, and the Japanese lied to the public.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the second bomb was dropped, they told the truth immediately because they had no choice. So that ended the war, and then a plane flew over, and we wrote PW on the roof. They circled left, and then the bird disappeared. He knew the war was over before we did. He skipped out and hid out in the mountains for 10 or 12 years. In the meantime, a TBF flew over from a carrier and sent us the Morse code in red light, that the war was over. And we were in the river for the first time swimming. We always wanted to go in that fresh water to clean ourselves. They wouldn't let us do it.
Mm.
But then the day they let us do it, I thought, well, maybe the war is over. And so anyway, we came out of there, and the TBF dropped a long red streamer. And we picked it up, and on the end was a candy bar with a bite out of it and a pack of cigarettes with one cigarette missing. We had to divide both of those up with several hundred men.
Mm.
We had to form circles, and one cigarette. Everybody takes one puff, and so it goes around the circle. It was really funny, but we were serious. And then the chocolate, we got a little teeny sliver just to taste it, and that was it. Now, Commander Fitzgerald of the Perch submarine, he was in command, a highest-ranking officer with us, and he made sure that everybody got one puff of cigarette and a little taste of the chocolate. And then, of course, the B-29s came over and dropped tons of food on us, and instead of hating the guards, they were complaining about their families starving at home, so we gave them a lot of food from the bombers.
Well, your stomachs probably couldn't take that much anyway.
Well, the thing is, the commander warned the guys, you know, you haven't been eating good food. You've been eating seaweed and barley for years, and so take it easy on the food. Well, some guys were so hungry, they just, pea soup was supposed to be diluted with a can of water, and they would eat it straight. So some guys got diarrhea from that, but the smart guys just ate a little more every day until they got used to it.
And isn't it incredible that after all that, these emaciated Americans were willing to share that food with their Japanese guards? I cut Louis off there. I didn't let him finish the story about the bird and that beam that he had to hold above his head for 37 minutes. Well, after 37 minutes, the bird punched him in the stomach, the beam fell on Louis's head, and knocked him unconscious. Not that you didn't think it was bad before, but now I think you have an even clearer picture of how brutally Louis was treated.
I took my time coming home, by the way. I got fattened up. And I was back to a normal weight by the time I got to San Francisco. And it was really, and that's another story, the repatriation. You could do another book on that.
I believe it. Maybe you should.
Anyway, I went to hell and almost got killed on the way home. You know, there was a bomber. We were supposed to fly to Manila, but socked in. I'm leaving Okinawa now. I'm gradually working my way home. We were told to land at Loag, a small city in northern Luzon, on a fighter strip, stayed there all night. The next day they gave us clearance to go to Manila, and we took off with this bomber full of about 40 prisoners inside, and the runway's too short. There was a berm on the end of the runway that they put there to keep the ocean from flooding the runway. And I was up there between the pilot and co-pilot, and I knew we weren't going to make it, and they did too. We hit the berm, bounced in the air, and settled so low that the white caps came through the bomb bay doors and got all the prisoners wet. And I thought, this is it. After all I've been through, I'm dead. And then the plane gradually pulled up. We got to Manila. Now, a couple of years ago, I got a call from a fellow in the East, and he asked me how I got to Manila. When I told him about that bomber taking off, he said, well, I was the pilot, and I almost went in my pants. So, yeah. Anyway, that's really funny. Yeah. So anyway, I got home, and of course, the big celebrations, and I had a ball, and then I finally got married. But I had a terrible nightmare. I had these nightmares in prison about the bird. I was always strangling the guy, and I had that nightmare all the way home. I never missed a night. And before I got married, I had a nightmare every night. After I got married, I still had the nightmares. And I'm always strangling the bird. And I grabbed my wife by the throat one night, and boy, I got scared. I woke up in a cold sweat, and then I started to drink heavily and became a boozer. And then she decided it was time for a divorce. But then somebody talked her into going down to hear a new young evangelist, Billy Graham. And she came home speaking of this peace and joy she had in her heart and life. And I wouldn't go with her. I got mad. But then she said something that made me happy. She said, because of my conversion, I'm not going to get a divorce. Well, that softened me up a little bit, so I did go down to hear Billy. But I walked out the first night mad. I said, I'll never go back to that place again. But the next day, after 2 hours of argument, she got me back. As I started to leave, he was in his preaching, he said, when people come to the end of their rope, there's nowhere else to turn. They turn to God, no matter who you are. I thought, yeah, that's what happened to me on the raft in prison camp on Kwajalein. And that made me feel like a fool. I prayed the same prayer over and over again. God, get me home alive, and I'll seek you and serve you. Here I am alive, and I didn't try to seek God. So then I went forward in the meeting and made a confession of my faith in Christ. And, boy, I knew something happened. I was still on my knees, but I knew I was through getting drunk. I knew I'd forgiven all my guard, and including the bird. That was something. And I was a different person. Right there on my knees, I got up, went home, and that's, my life has been changed ever since.
And you eventually became a missionary in Japan, the same country that had tortured you. You talked about the bird, and you forgave him. I guess you did, if you would go back there to Japan to try to share this new love in your life with them.
I went back to Japan. Sagamo Prison, that's where all the prisoners were, 850 of them, and nobody was allowed in there. But I called MacArthur's headquarters, SAC, and reminded him that he asked for 10 million Bibles and 2,000 missionaries when he took over the country, but we didn't respond. And that's all. He let me into Sagamo Prison, so I was the first outsider allowed in there to speak, and 850 war criminals. And the colonel asked me to give them a chance to become Christians, so I did. And then he asked those who knew me to come forward. So about 8 guards came forward, and sure enough, there was James Sasaki, head interrogator in Japan proper, and he's the one that went to SC with me in 37, 38, 39. So I said, well, where's the bird? And he said, well, we believe he committed harakiri. So I assumed he was dead all these years, and then when CBS did my show out of Nagano during the Olympics, Donna Mihailovich was in Tokyo, and he called me and he said, are you sitting down? Yeah. You got a hold of your chair? I said, I got a hold of my chair. What's up? He says, we found the bird. He's alive. Oh, I couldn't believe it. So anyway, they took a picture of a movie of him, and it was on 60 Minutes. And that's still being shown across the nation. The Olympic Committee sends them out to schools. And so everybody can see the entire story in about 35 minutes.
And that is online, and I'll make sure that we point a link to that.
Yeah, they called it the Great Zamperini, which I didn't like, but he said, well, you know, there was the Great Mussolini, the Great Zucchini, and the Great Houdini. So I thought, well, in that case, I'll leave it.
You prefer Lucky Louie, huh?
Yeah, Lucky Louie's fine. A great. I don't think anybody's great.
That humility only made him more endearing. The late, great Louis Zamperini. Boy, it brought back a lot of good memories and some inspiring thoughts by revisiting his story this week. I hope you found it as valuable as I did. And I hope you can join us again next time on Hometown Heroes, when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.